I'm going to talk to you about ETTM, a scalable fault-tolerant network manager, which was joint work done with a bunch of people at UMass and at the University of Washington. So I'm going to start off by telling you a little bit about my background. Before I came to grad school, for all the power and the money that it entails, I was a network IT manager. I worked at a variety of publishing companies and then running websites for nonprofits. So I actually have some idea of what I want from a network. And so sort of I have this bucket list of sort of six things that I think most networks today you're probably going to want. You want a NAT in order to share a couple of IP addresses, especially with IPv4 addresses running out. You want a firewall to keep the bad guys out, some kind of traffic prioritization to make sure that your web traffic isn't slowed down by bulk transfers, a transparent web cache for all the reasons that we like transparent web caches, remote access or VPN, and some kind of IDS or, you know, worm detection thing running inside your network. And in order to get this for any reasonably sized network today, it really involves buying several proprietary middle boxes and setting them up. And even when you get things set up, the solution is potentially inconsistent, it's inextensible, and it doesn't automatically scale as you increase the size of your network. And so just to illustrate this point, I'm going to start with intrusion detection, but you should be able to pretty easily take what I'm going to say and expand it to the other application that I was talking about. So intrusion detection today is typically deployed at the edge of your network, and you can imagine it being this red firewall in the middle of your network here. And it watches traffic as it comes in and out of your host, of your network. If the traffic is fine, it doesn't do anything. If it sees some kind of attack traffic, it's going to raise an alarm as to something's going on that's fishy. And it might actually block that traffic, it might just raise an alert to a network administrator so they can understand what they need to be worrying about in the future. And it can even do things like detect traffic that leaves your network and actually assign blame to it and say, well, you might have an infected node somewhere in your network that you need to go figure out. But because it's deployed only at the edge, it's difficult to catch internal threats. And so if some machine inside your network becomes infected and starts sort of attacking other machines inside your network, it oftentimes goes without notice. And you might think, well, you just need to increase your deployment. You just need to add extra boxes. And not only is that kind of expensive and that you have to go buy these boxes, which are not cheap, and deploy them and hope that you deploy them in the right places so that we get all the visibility that you want, but many of these objects are actually stateful, and in order to keep consistency and make correct decisions, you need to get these things to coordinate and communicate with each other. And so you can imagine sort of that this isn't going to be a very nice problem to solve, and you're relying upon sort of proprietary vendors in order to provide you with a solution rather than being able to extend it yourself. And so we're going to propose a radically different approach, and we call it an end to the middle, or ETTM, and it's sort of a throwback to the end-to-end argument. And it stems from the realization that we don't need physically centralized objects to get logically centralized control. So we're going to build virtual middle boxes out of commodity software running on end hosts, which are going to carry out the tasks as though you had gone out and bought all of these middle boxes, and actually, in doing so, give you much better properties for your network and your ability to manage it easily. So if we return to this IDS example, but do it in the context of ETTM, we're going to assume that we have a trusted shim layer running at the bottom of every host on our network. And that gives us a point of monitoring and control in the network. And so when a host goes rogue and starts sending traffic, it will be a very short time interval before you can actually collect the samples, realize what's going on, and isolate that host from the rest of your network, rather than having basically no monitoring infrastructure or very expensive monitoring infrastructure inside your network. And you can imagine how you would extend this to the other applications, and in fact, I'll go through one of them in a bit. So before I go into the design of why it is that I think you can actually do this, I'd like to go through my assumptions and sort of state the operating environment, which I think this is most applicable to. So we've really been focusing on enterprise networks, so not the data center, not transit networks. We're looking at a single administrative domain. We want a single network administrator or a group of network administrators to be able to go out and get more control over their networks. Then we're going to make a series of assumptions about hosts. We're going to assume they have trusted computing hardware so that way we can actually figure out what exact software they're running. They're going to be multi-cores so that way we can figure out that we can run processing on them without interfering too much with what else the host is doing. That they're virtualized, and that'll become clear why that's useful in a second. And we're going to assume that the switches themselves actually provide some form of access control. So we can decide which hosts to give access to or not give access to our network, and also what kind of access to give them. Fortunately, all these requirements I've placed in hardware are actually pretty easy to meet. So today, commodity PCs are increasingly virtualized, increasingly multi-core, and increasingly have trusted computing hardware inside of them. And that's only becoming more true with time. And switches that provide access control are already commonplace. Most even commodity switches today support a protocol called 802.1x, which provides basic access control. And OpenFlow, which is an emerging standard which it seems like everybody is using, is also going to support these kinds of features. And so given that assumption, we have three goals. And these three goals really correspond to extensibility, scalability, and consistency. And so first, we want to make it easy for people to extend their networks. And we do this by building one platform with an API so you can write network management code as software. Program your network as though it was a platform rather than a collection of heterogeneous hardware devices. Second, we want to automatically scale with network demand. And we do this by running management on already present end hosts, in particular the hosts that users are already running. And this means that if you double the size of your network, you get twice as many monitoring points and twice as much computation power for free to go out and do what it is that you need to do with your network. And lastly, we want to function pervasively, consistently, and tolerate faults. And pervasiveness we get from running on end hosts, but we still need to deal with consistency and fault tolerance. To do this, we're going to use a relatively standard distributed consensus algorithm called Paxos, and I'll go into a little bit of detail of how we use that in a bit. So now that I've given you an idea of what it is that I'm trying to do and why it might matter, I'm going to go into the design of ETTM, then I'll evaluate what we've built, and finally I'll conclude and take your questions. So if you're really thinking about running most of your network management tasks on commodity devices, there's a series of challenges that come up. Possibly first and foremost is, can we trust these devices to do what we ask them to do? Commodity OSs are notorious for being compromised, and the people who use them are notorious for configuring them in selfish ways, not the way that the network administrator wants them to be configured. And can commodity PCs quickly make consistent decisions? Paxos is known to be kind of a heavyweight operation. And lastly, can we enable developers and administrators to actually go build this stuff out like software and deploy it on their networks easily? And so I'm going to walk through the set of three challenges and in the process build up the architecture we use for a given ETTM host. And hopefully you'll have some idea of what it is that we're using to solve these problems. So the first question is, can we trust these PCs? And I think the answer in a commodity PC, commodity OS, the answer is obviously not. Commodity OSs are notorious for being compromised, and users are going to configure it however they want, not however the network administrator wants it. So the first step, you might say, well, we need some point of control. Let's introduce a hypervisor. That gives us a point where we can actually interpose between what the commodity OS asks us to do the network and what the network actually sees. But this doesn't really help us because we have no way of knowing if it's actually there. Anybody will lie and claim there's a hypervisor there if it means that they get better access to the network. So we actually extend the hypervisor with support for trusted computing hardware, and in particular a TPM, which lets us attest to the fact that we booted not only a hypervisor, but a particular hypervisor. But just knowing that doesn't actually help you very much unless you can force hosts to not be able to access the network if they're not running the one that you want. So we actually extend the 802.1x network authorization protocol to use trusted computing information rather than using normal sort of key exchanges. So that way we can actually deny access if you're not running the particular software that we want. And finally, rather than running network management tasks actually inside the hypervisor itself, where it would add to the trusted computing base and just make integration somewhat difficult, we create a special virtual machine called an attested execution environment, or an AEE. And that's where we actually run network management tasks. And so at this point, you actually can believe that you have a reasonable place to go run network tasks, and they'll be carried out faithfully on all hosts which you've allowed access to your network. So second, can we quickly make consistent decisions? For this, we're going to use a distributed consensus protocol, Paxos, and in particular a shared table abstraction that I'll talk about on the next few slides. And the last question is, how can we enable developers and administrators to build applications and get them out there? And so you're going to build a set of APIs. We're going to add a set of APIs around filters and micro virtual router, which is actually what allows for packet interposition and control and monitoring over these packet flows. And we're going to expose these two different sets of APIs up to developers so they can write network services and actually deploy, give them to network administrators to deploy easily. So I'm going to step through in a little bit more detail the particular mechanisms we use to address these challenges, and then I'm going to wrap up sort of bringing everything together in one concrete example. So trusted authorization is what we call the system whereby we can only allow hosts onto the network if we believe that they're running a software stack that we like. And I'm going to talk a little bit in a second about hosts that aren't going to be willing to change their software stack, but for now let's assume that we have hosts that are willing to change their software stack. So a given host is going to attempt to prove to a verification server that it is running the right stack. And the verification server you can run either on a dedicated piece of hardware or you can run it actually inside of an attested execution environment on an already vetted host. So the first thing which happens is that the switch is going to realize that a new host has been attached and send a challenge saying, who are you and why should you have access to the network? That takes about 50 milliseconds in our experience, and we think this could be driven down by having the host can actually contact it first. Second, the end host responds with its identity and the public key it's going to use to sign its state, which is tunneled to the verification server, which responds with a challenge nonce. That way, the eventual attestation will be fresh. This takes about 20 milliseconds. The bulk of the time, about a second, is consumed by actually signing the attestate of the machine and sending it back. And this takes so long because it's a public key operation on a very lightweight device, a TPM. And in the future, there's a lot of evidence that TPMs are going to become faster and perhaps even integrated into the CPU, where this time will be drastically reduced. Finally, the host and the verification server exchange information about the policy and software, which might need to be updated, and the port is enabled on the switch, enabling it to get access to the network. In total, this takes just over a second, and it can be easily overlaid with the boot of the commodity operating system, effectively making the wait time vanish. And so we think this is usable today and likely to go down drastically in the future. So I promised I was going to talk about legacy hosts and what happens if you're not willing to or can't run the particular software stack we would like you to. Say, for instance, an iPad. So when an iPad connects to your network, it's going to be immediately denied access because it doesn't run the software stack in question. But the great observation is that AEs are virtual objects, and they need not actually run on the hardware that they are filtering. So we can go find another host on the network somewhere, instantiate an attested execution environment for the iPad, establish a secure and rate-limited tunnel between the two of them using, say, OpenFlow, and then actually allow access to the network on behalf of this device. So at this point, we have a network which every device on the network, be it a full-powered PC or a printer, can actually have its access filtered, and we can actually control directly the bytes which are going to appear. So if you're running all of this on end hosts, you also have to worry about things going up and down all the time. Power might go off, somebody might close the lid on their laptop. You don't want Bob and accounting's machine going down to take down your entire network. So to do this, we create a shared table abstraction, which is backed by Paxos. So each row is a particular application, and you can have multiple rows per application if you want, but you can imagine so the NAT row is keeping a set of mappings from externally visible addresses to internally visible addresses. And each row is a set of status updates, and when you iterate across them all, you can build the state of that application back up. And each individual cell is the result of a single Paxos round. Now, those of you that remember Paxos in detail will note that Paxos only guarantees that it will make progress if a majority of the hosts are up. And if you're running in an enterprise environment on commodity devices, you can imagine the power going out on a floor of your building, and that might take out a majority of your nodes. So we allow for unsafe progress if an application decides that it can tolerate that. So if a majority of the nodes fail, the NAT application might say, I am willing to tolerate unsafe progress to continue to deliver service to the remainder of people. It declares by fiat a new set of members of the Paxos group and starts to make progress at the separate group. And at a later date, we allow the application to carefully merge the changes back in. And while in theory this should be very difficult, in practice we found that most applications admit reasonable ways of dealing with conflicts. In the NAT example, you can simply look if two different flows are using the same external facing address and send TCP resets or block all traffic in both directions. And then eventually we garbage collect this forked row and can continue to make progress as normal when the majority of the hosts are back up. So to actually take effect and monitor traffic, you need some way to interpose on all these flows. We have something we're calling the micro virtual router, which enables you to interpose these filters on specific packets in specific orders. And we have a hybrid implementation. One, the fast path is using Open vSwitch and gets line speed up to a few gigabits per second, but is limited to the OpenFlow API and thus really packet header modifications. We also have an IP tables based implementation, which allows for full C++ filters and access to the entirety of the packet, including payload, but slows performance down to about 250 megabits per second. We could also extend this easily to use even faster hardware, like, say, server switch that was presented earlier today. The filters themselves conform to a relatively straightforward API, and this is what you would actually write, plus an ability to go manage this shared table if you were going to write a filter. The first five functions are really all about just giving hints to the micro virtual router about when to run filters and on what packets. Whereas the last three functions specify what you can actually do with packets, including drop, delay, rewrite, and even inject packets, as well as the ability to maintain whatever state you need to maintain and periodically run bookkeeping information. So when we put this all together into the working system, I'm going to sort of walk through one example, in particular a network address translator. So on the left, we have the architecture of a single host. It's going to be a host creating a flow. On the top right, we're going to have the logical Paxos shared table abstraction. And we're going to implement a NAT. And this NAT, and so a NAT does is it logically shares one or a small number of IP addresses amongst a larger number of hosts by maintaining a set of mappings from externally visible addresses to internally visible addresses. Traditionally, this operates in a centralized place where it can see all traffic and make consistent decisions in one place and apply those mappings. And instead, we're going to try and maintain this in a distributed fashion. So when an application wants to send a packet for the beginning of a new flow, it's going to send the packet. It's going to be intercepted by the hypervisor and forwarded up to the attested execution environment, and in particular the micro virtual router, which is going to see that the NAT filter should apply to this packet and forward it up to the NAT filter. The NAT filter is going to look at the packet and say, this is the beginning of a new flow, so we're going to need a new mapping. So it's going to request that the consensus subsystem give it a new mapping for this flow. This is going to start a Paxos round, which is going to go out to all of the other hosts in the network that are participating in Paxos. And we actually can use a subset of the nodes to participate in Paxos in order to increase scalability. These nodes are eventually going to agree on a mapping, in this case C maps to D. And that value is going to be returned to the host when it gets the notification that this has been an accepted thing. That's going to be then returned back up to the NAT filter, which can apply it to the packet and forward the packet out to the general internet as soon as possible. And then in the future, packets belonging to this flow can be translated with just purely local state without involving the consensus because we've already established the mapping. And so this was just a simple example with a NAT, but you can imagine how you would use this to build the variety of other applications that I was talking about. So next I'm just going to step through the evaluation of what it is that we've built and try to convince you that this is actually feasible to go deploy in an enterprise. So first, we've built out six different applications, and these cover five of the six applications that I put up on the first slide. The one thing that's missing is VPN, and we're working on building that right now. But we built a network address translator, or a NAT. We built a deep packet inspection system to do intrusion detection, a web cache, a traffic prioritization scheme, a worm scan detector, as well as a general purpose firewall. And all of these are about a few hundred lines of code, and they're relatively straightforward code to go through and read. They're really just about saying, well, I have this state, here's how to replicate that state into Paxos, and here's how to apply this state to packets. And so rather than go into deep detail about the performance of any one of these given applications, I'm going to try and sort of answer the questions about sort of what might go wrong with this if you were going to implement it on end hosts, because you can imagine that would delay things. So the first question you might be asking is consensus fast enough? If you're going to be making sort of these collaborative decisions about things, this might slow things down. So in our experience, we can make fault-tolerant decisions on a LAN in about a millisecond. And my understanding is that state-of-the-art is a little bit better than that. And I think there's going to be a talk in the next session about making this really, really fast. So you should go to Bill Belosky's talk, although I apologize if I get the topic of that wrong because the paper wasn't posted until today, I think. So we can do this pretty quickly. You can make decisions on a per-flow, per-round trip time basis even. So second, you might ask, well, does consensus scale? You're going to have a lot of hosts running around. How many can you actually support? So with 19 nodes in a Paxos group, we can support about 1,700 new operations per second. So that's 1,700 new flows per second in the case of the NAT. And in practice, we run on a subset of the nodes in the network. So this is pretty reasonable. Further, if you need scalability, you can always partition what you're managing. So if you have two externally facing IP addresses, you can have two different groups manage the two different IP addresses and essentially get linear improvements in scalability. So then you might be thinking, well, what about filters? You're going to be running some little bit of packet processing on every single packet that comes into or leaves the host. Couldn't this impact the performance? And so this is a graph of the network address translator running versus a just direct flow. And it's looking at the throughput as a function of the flow size. And the things to note are that we can achieve the full gigabit per second of the link which we were running on with no appreciable difference. And that actually for all flows bigger than 10 kilobytes, which is to say almost any flow that ever happens anymore anywhere, we see performance that's identical to doing it with no filtering. So we think filters are actually a pretty scalable thing. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about one application, which is our bandwidth allocator, our traffic prioritization engine. And this is just because this involves some more deeply coordinated actions that happen on behalf of a variety of hosts. And so what we're looking at here is sort of what happens if you have no bandwidth allocation process on your network. And so we run a BitTorrent flow in the background. You can see the blue line is request to google.com. And then a BitTorrent flow starts and causes all of the queues in your network to build up to the point at which they're actually dropping packets, which actually, in this case, is about 10 seconds worth of queuing. So you see things take as long as 10 seconds. This is not 10 seconds worth of queuing. It's a long queue. The net result of Google is to get about 10 seconds long for a given request to Google. And this is pretty abysmal. So instead, we built a bandwidth allocation thing based on reservations. So each flow that is running on your network actually goes out and says, here's how much bandwidth I would like. And we allocate it on a per flow, per round trip time basis, and then rate limit the flows directly at the host generating the traffic. And so then when we apply this to the BitTorrent example, we see that the BitTorrent flow is throttled back to a very reasonable amount of bandwidth, isn't destroying your queues, and actually you see perfectly reasonable latencies to access to Google.com despite a very high bandwidth, very, very large flow going on in the background. And so making these decisions on a per flow, per round trip time basis, and doing still getting good results, we think indicates that this is a very flexible approach, that you can use it for both coarse grain coordination and actually pretty fine grained decision making processes. And so in conclusion, I hope that I've convinced you that enterprise network today is sort of a complex, expensive, and somewhat ultimately unsatisfying venture to be involved in. And we're proposing a radically new approach, which is to implement almost all network functionality on end hosts as software. This gives you extensibility because it's easy to write new software packages that manage your network. It gives you management resources that automatically scale with the new host that you bring into your network. And it automatically gives you tasks which run pervasively, consistently, and tolerate faults. And lastly, we've implemented a variety of interesting applications, and we're continuing in order to work on making it more real and giving it more applications. So with that, I'll take your questions.
Hi, Ashok Narayanan, Cisco. The thing I'm thinking about is whether instead of running it as a VM on the host, you could run it as a low power PC on the network jack.
I think that would be a really interesting thing to look at. We have not looked at power really at all. Our current theory has sort of been that if you're running a PC, you're already using almost all the power you'd be using it if you were actually doing something with it.
Not electrical power, I mean computing power.
So in practice, for most things in an enterprise, performance is, the bandwidth rates that you're dealing with are reasonably low with a few exceptions, and the latencies can be tolerated a few milliseconds extra. So I think you could scale this down really well. I think you could do this in a low power, embedded PC attached to your NIC if you wanted to. The question is, can you still manage to keep it sort of tightly coupled with general purpose processing that can deal with the occasional bursts?
Thanks.
I really enjoyed the talk. Brad Karp, UCL. I just had a question about privacy. So it seems like, I didn't hear anything about privacy anywhere in the talk, and it seems like maybe in a lot of deployed networks today, just simple isolation from switch ports affords users some amount of privacy just because they're not on a broadcast bus network anymore. And so now your desktop is going to get a shot at my outbound traffic, and I could just hook up a hub to your network port, you could hook up a hub to your network port and sniff my traffic.
Yes. So what I'd really like is something that's WPA2-like for wired networks that creates cryptographically meaningful, authenticated connections between the switch you're attached to and the particular virtual machine, the test execution environment, which would actually mean that the traffic would be encrypted. Given that we do it in wireless networks today in hardware without it being too power hungry, I have to imagine it could be done in switches. For the time being, it is true unless you use some pretty exotic, like 802.1AE MACsec style stuff. Which does actually sort of MAC layer encryption. That sort of privacy issue, it does come up, although there are ways to mitigate it.
Thank you.
I should say that we actually use so you have to actually tap the wire rather than going at it through your just commodity operating system. It does require hardware.
Yeah, that's right, a hub.
Yeah.
Right.
Madison? So I was wondering whether many of these things might be simplified if you had Knox controller and there have been many approaches like Ethan and others, and which kind of try to manage all these things, well as like people have argued about the scaling it, like DFIN and others.
So yeah, there's a whole bunch of work, including Nox, Onyx, Ethane, and all sorts of things that sort of try and use varying degrees of programmability in the network in order to go out and do really interesting stuff. Mostly they focus on path selection, rather than sort of the complete suite of what you'd like to have out of your network, which includes all sorts of crazy things that are implemented well in general purpose hardware. And so absolutely everything they've done is related. In fact, we've intentionally stayed somewhat away from programming the switches themselves because we think that there are other existing solutions which we could pair ourselves with in order to do really interesting and cool stuff. So it's great work, and we'd love to work with them in order to get a complete solution where I can actually write programs that run on your network.
Thanks. I have a question. You could repeat it.
Sure. I'm going to repeat the question. It'll be fine.
If you have an enterprise or a large place like a hotel like this with lots of mobile hosts repeatedly connecting to different access points and sort of in general moving around, does that change anything you've done, or did you just get everything work out of the box?
So the question was, how does mobility change things, and how does having many hosts or just sort of different disconnecting and reconnecting to different places on the network change things? So if you believe that those are the only hosts on your network, that would probably change things. If you believe that there is some core of hosts that are sort of well connected and reasonably, and reasonably consistently there, then you're going to put the sort of Paxos operations thing like that on those hosts that are well connected in there, and you're just going to be having these other hosts sort of participating in that by asking to have the new IP addresses, new location, the mapping is mapped up. So I think in the case where they're making up sort of a minority of the hosts, it'll work really well, or even just as long as there's some core left over. If they're all of the hosts, I think you'd have to rethink some of this, but I don't think it necessarily makes it impossible. But you can imagine, if you had a rack of machines somewhere in the building, that could give you the core that you needed and everything else would work.
I'm Wojtek from HP Labs. You mentioned that in some cases you allow unsafe progress in Paxos.
Yes.
So when you make that compromise, you give up the nice features of Paxos, and yet you're still paying the cost of using it. So why is Paxos the right protocol in this context?
So in normal operating conditions, I expect that it would come up almost never, which is to say that most of the time that hosts are being taken off, it's either planned or some piece of software can run and say that, oh, this host is going to be disconnecting. And as long as that churn rate stays reasonably low, then you can just change the membership dynamically. That feature is there for in the case that, you have a power outage in a large part of your building or something like that. And I think the properties of Paxos gives you, both of all in the general case and also sort of before and after you make this readjustment, is really nice, which is that you get a safe list. And two safe lists that might have to be merged is a lot better than one jumble of nothing I can say anything about.
Okay, thank you very much.
Absolutely.